The method of sustaining wholesome states is to practice mindfulness. And I was going to drop the mic and walk out of the room. But I won't do that. I will share some reflections on the path of practice and cultivation. Although I think there is some truth in that synopsis. You know, the Buddha said that mindfulness was the direct path for purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method for the realization of nibbana. That's no small statement. Doesn't get any more wholesome than nibbana.
Here are the top search results.
Uh-oh. Sometimes my phone hears something, and I'll just turn this off. There we go. I have an Android phone, and the way you activate Android's version of Siri is by saying, "Hey, Google." It's quite often the case that my wife will call me from in the room, "Hey, Gulu," and my phone will say, "How can I help you?" So I do want to share some reflections on cultivation, the path of practice, and really these four wise efforts are kind of orientation, kind of movement towards skillful, movement towards away from what's unskillful. Reorient, it gives us a sort of metric to orient ourselves, that when we drop the question, what's happening now, how is it in this moment, that we have a kind of metric to evaluate wholesome, unwholesome. If it's, I think it was Gil who once I heard him say that the essence of this practice is whatever state you find yourself in, don't make it worse. That's a biggie. We tend to do that out of habit. And if you can, make it better. It's a really nice synopsis. It's a way of, can add it to our mindfulness practice, that as we check in and, you know, we have different practices we may have done, to add the evaluation of wholesome and unwholesome to that. And I feel like if, you know, always aspiring to move toward the wholesome, but sometimes that's difficult. If I can't, at least I know which direction to face. Like, at least, like, set myself up to go in the right direction. And I've not really practiced in the Zen or Mahayana traditions, but I'm very inspired by the idea of a bodhisattva vow, and the vows that I have. There's many, many versions of this, but the vows that I wanted to share with you are, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. Delusions are endless. I vow to cut through them all. The teachings are infinite. I vow to learn them all. The Buddha's way is inconceivable. I vow to attain it. And what I find so inspiring about these vows, and, you know, if you go to a Zen center, I spend some time at Green Gulch. Every day they chant some version of these multiple times a day. And one doesn't take this kind of vow with the idea that you'll achieve it. I mean, they're written so that they're impossible. The impossibility of achieving it is built into the vow. But by taking it, you make a commitment to keep moving in the direction, keep moving in the direction of the wholesome. Before I found this practice, I used to be very much more at effect of my moods. And it seemed like the mood was just a immutable and random reality. Like I would wake up on the wrong side of the bed with no idea why, and then I'd be grumpy all day and just resigned to being grumpy all day. And I knew it didn't feel good, but there was a kind of like paralysis, like, okay, well, today's a grumpy day. And then the mood inevitably would shift at some point, and I have no sense of what shifted it or the moment in which it shifted. It was just really kind of like outside my worldview that one could actually have agency over such a thing. And I was exposed to meditation as a child, but I really found my practice after I went to law school, and I worked really hard. I had good fortune. I did well, and went to work for a fancy LA law firm. And for so many years, I had oriented my life around this kind of notion of success and achievement. And then when I got there, I was absolutely miserable. I was overworked and I was overstressed. And there was this atmosphere that kind of pervaded the environment. Like it was kind of like a vague fear. And I say vague because the things that you would fear, like losing your job or being humiliated or being yelled at, I never saw those things happen, but yet there was this like kind of strange atmosphere of fear. And I got very depressed for the first time in my life. In my mid-20s, I was quite depressed, sort of barely able to function, lost all my enthusiasm and gusto for life. And beneath all of this, a kind of searing anger, like, you know, I've been lied to, I've been betrayed. People told me this was the way to happiness, and it utterly failed. And that's when I found the practice, and it really, you know, it saved me. I was able to relate to that in a very different way and eventually make different kinds of decisions. And anger is tricky. As the Buddha referred to anger as a honey-tipped arrow with a poison root. That honey tip is sometimes quite alluring, you know. You know it's unwholesome, but it can feel good. You have energy, might feel powerful. Even having righteous indignation is, in some ways, feels better than doing nothing. But there's a poison root. It's like an illness. And I think and one of the things that I noticed in that period of like being very angry was that I was actually quite attached to that. I sort of like took that on as part of my identity, and was quite loyal to that suffering, which I think can happen for a lot of us. This is from The Onion. Inspired man bolts out of bed at 3 a.m. to jot down great new worry. Patterson, New Jersey. Quickly kicking off the sheets and reaching for a notepad on his nightstand, local 27-year-old Kyle Dowling reportedly sprang out of bed at 3 a.m. yesterday to jot down an idea for a brand new worry. Quote, sometimes the best, most crippling anxieties just come to you in the middle of the night, so it's good always to have a pen and paper nearby to record them, said Dowling, rapidly scribbling several shorthand notes about a new feeling of debilitating self-doubt and apprehension that had just entered his mind. If I think of a new paralyzing fear relating to my personal or professional life and I don't immediately write it down, there's a good chance I'll totally forget about it. Upon waking up and rereading his notes from the previous night, Dowling confirmed to reporters that the new worry was even greater than he first thought. I very much relate to that. I used to keep a list of sort of like grievances. I don't know who I thought I was going to give them to or what purpose they served. You know, it was a little bit cathartic to write them down. And, you know, like it's very cathartic when you write things down as a way of trying to let them go. But I was writing them down as a way of like not forgetting. And so this relationship I had with like not realizing or even imagining that one could have agency over cultivating your mind and cultivating, you know, even your moods, attitude of mind, The Buddha was actually quite, yeah, he addressed this. Like, I wonder if maybe people had similar ideas at the time. I know there were some ideas in that worldview about predestination and things were, you know, already written and predetermined. But he said it very clearly, you know, develop what is skillful, monks, he said. It is possible to develop what is skillful. If it were not possible to develop what is skillful, I would not say to you, develop what is skillful. I like this, not mincing words, like this is possible, and if it weren't possible, I wouldn't be talking about it. The Buddhist path talks a lot about cultivation. We in these Buddhist circles talk a lot about cultivation. Just for fun, I went on to Dharma Seed, which is a huge library of Buddhist teachings and these kinds of talks, and I searched for the word C-U-L-T-I-V, so cultivate, cultivation, and there were 280 pages of results, like maybe 2,000-3,000 talks that have this word in the title. The notion of cultivation is central to the path, and the Buddha used this word, Pali word bhavana, which is very similar to English in that it has this sort of dual meaning of cultivating whatever we're trying to develop and also to cultivate plants, to grow crops or grow plants. And I love that because tending to crops or growing plants is very similar to cultivating the inner world. When you want to plant crops, you plant the seeds, you have to plant the right seeds for the place that you're planting them. Wholesome seeds, you plant them in the right place in terms of soil and sun and water. You tend to the soil, maybe you amend it with compost. You might need to water the plants. Sometimes seedlings need a little bit of shade. But you can't make them sprout. You can try to create the kinds of conditions in which they'll sprout, but you don't control what happens. It's a little bit like my snow globe that I like to play with. You know, you can't make it settle down. You have to just let it create the conditions for it settling down. In the case of snow globe, is to put them down. If you try to, you know, first time I ever planted seeds, I kept digging them up to see if they were sprouting. Like I was 4 or 5 years old, and they never did. Of course, you know, you have to let them marinate and do their thing in their own time. And meditative cultivation is exactly the same thing. We don't necessarily directly control our state of mind, our state of heart, but we more and more can create conditions that will lead to the wholesome, the conditions that become habits, that more and more we go to those wholesome places. There's a section of the Anguttara Nikaya, so one of the volumes of the Buddhist teachings, and it's known as the snap of the fingers section. And I love this idea. The Buddha says that if one were to enact one of the four wise efforts for even the snap of a finger, even for that short duration, it's a great thing. The way they describe it is one has done their duty by their teacher and eats the alms food of the country without a debt. Like you've fulfilled your purpose. This is an acknowledgement of, you know, how difficult this is, and also a kind of, seems to me like an encouragement, you know, just a moment, moment by moment, little by little, this is how we cultivate. I don't know if this is an aside, but I found this to be very helpful and interesting. You know, the Buddha said that some practitioners will have to go practice that is painful and slow. Others will find practice is painful and quick. Others will find practice pleasant and slow. And others will find practice pleasant and quick. And that we have to adjust our effort accordingly. And also that it may be different for us each time. you practice. Maybe we have some tendencies. I mean, you probably know where you fit in this. Of course, we all want it to be pleasant and quick, but it's not always like that. When the practice is difficult, and you know, many of you have reported this in the meetings, I like to reflect on a quote from Ajahn Chah, the Thai forest meditation master, and he said, you know, there's two kinds of suffering. There's the suffering that leads to more suffering, and then there's the suffering that leads to freedom. And when we're in practice and we're moving toward our suffering to accept the truth that there is suffering in this incarnation, to practice to intimately know that suffering, to feel that suffering, that's the suffering that leads to freedom. You know, when we're caught in our afflictive habits or acting out with ill will or in other harmful ways, and that's the suffering that leads to more suffering. And often in practice, there's a kind of vacillation. Many of you have reported this too, that there can be a pendulum swing between periods of ease and calm, the mind is more steady, to periods of activation where the practice is more uncomfortable, we're more caught in the hindrances that Inez spoke about yesterday. It's part of the package of how practice works. I've heard this described as, you know, periods of purity and periods of purification. When things are peaceful and calm and easy, we can rest in a kind of purity that's arisen from practice. And when things are more difficult and we practice being steady and ardent and diligent, upright and aware in the midst of that difficult experience, we can trust that the afflictive energies are being purified in some way. It was right in the preamble, the pitch for meditation, it's the direct path for the purification of beings. It's a quote from Pema Chodron. On the journey of the warrior bodhisattva, the path goes down, not up, as if the mountain pointed toward the earth instead of the sky. Instead of transcending the suffering of all creatures, we move toward turbulence and doubt however we can. We explore the reality and unpredictability of insecurity and pain while trying not to push it away. If it takes years, if it takes lifetimes, we let it be as it is. At our own pace, without speed or aggression, we move down and down and down, with us millions of others, companions in awakening. Also, we were talking about this I'm going to read a poem from Hafiz. We were talking about this in the teacher room, that some of these translations, I think, Sufi poets are quite poetic and probably not literal. I just want to acknowledge that, because I have some Persian friends who have asked me to do that. So this is, maybe Hafiz said something like this. Don't surrender your loneliness so quickly. Let it cut more deep. Let it ferment and season you as few human or even divine ingredients can. Something missing in my heart tonight has made my eyes so soft, my voice so tender, my need of divinity absolutely clear. Paradoxically, sometimes as we get more mindfulness or get more mindful, the experience can become more unpleasant. Many of you have reported this in the meetings. Maybe we are noticing more subtle levels of agitation or activation that we don't have the sensitivity or the quiet to notice. And sometimes strong mindfulness reveals how much the mind wanders. It actually reveals more clearly that the mind is wandering all the time. I've had this experience, where there might be a sit and I might, you know, daydream for half the sit, come back to the breath for a while, and then daydream the other half of the sit. And contrast to that, when mindfulness is stronger and it doesn't take so long to notice the mind's wandered, I might bring myself every few minutes instead of coming back to the breath once, I might come back to the breath, you know, 40 or 50 times. Mindfulness is stronger. I'm definitely more present, but also noticing that I'm coming back so often. So it often feels like the mind is wandering more, but it could be that I'm just noticing that it's wandering more. So the cultivation practice requires patience, like with crops. We plant the seeds, tend to them, and wait for them to root and sprout. And creating these conditions requires some effort. You know, we talked about effort in terms of the guitar string, not too tight, not too loose. One of my teachers says not too aggressive, not too lazy. Requires some effort and also persistency, ardency, endurance. The Buddha said, one generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds, and exerts intent for the sake of arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen. It's a lot of action work, you know, desire, this kind of wholesome kind of desire for that which is wholesome, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds, and exerts. So it's not a completely passive activity. Goes on to say he generates, desires, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds, and exerts his intent for the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, and cultivation of skillful qualities that have arisen. This is called right effort. We can apply this effort of cultivation in so many ways. You know, that's why, as I was scrolling through the talks on Dharma Seed, you pick a quality of heart or mind or a wholesome quality, and you know, people are talking about how you would go about cultivating it. But the possibilities are, you know, kind of endless in a way. One way this is often talked about, you know, it's a contemplation, I guess, for us of what are we trying to cultivate. We spend a lot of time cultivating mindfulness. I'm going to talk a little bit about metta later. But even just the path, wise view, wise intent, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness and concentration, that more and more moments of wise mindfulness, more and more moments of wise speech, more and more moments where we practice harmlessness or loving kindness, that each moment of path activity is ripening the conditions that lead to the end of suffering, that lead to the wholesome. And I like this idea of path activity. You know, sometimes in practice there can be sort of like a confusion of, you know, what am I supposed to be doing? There's all these lists, so complicated, and you can really just still, you can distill it to that, you know, look at the Eightfold Path and just practice more and more moments of each of those path factors. And it's in the path activity, the activity on the path, that the cultivation happens. I can get so focused on, is it working? Is anything happening? You know, but it's not linear. You know, it doesn't just, it's cumulative. Another way cultivation is often spoken about in the Buddha's teachings is practicing with the seven factors of awakening. Many of you probably know this list, probably more than any. There's so much discussion about this list being given to people in difficulty, this list being given to people on their deathbeds. I think the Buddha asked for his Sariputra to give him a lesson on this teaching while he was ill. So some of you probably know this list, and it may be new for others, but I'll just give you the list. It's mindfulness, no surprise, starts with mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. Mindfulness is the key to our maturity or progress on the path. It's the core of what we're practicing here. Where do we place our attention? You know, especially in a time where so many things are competing for our attention. When I was logging on my computer today, Windows has a new thing. It's kind of annoying, but they give you a beautiful image. And then if you click on it to see where that image is, you get that image. You know, that's wholesome. It's nice scenery, pleasurable to watch. But then you get like their headlines. And the headline that popped up this morning was, "These three foods you eat every day are ruining your health." It's really hard not to click on that, even though I know that it's going down a rabbit hole and that it's clickbait. It's very, you know, there's so many things vying for our attention. And this mindfulness practice at its core is, how do we direct that attention wisely? And then investigation, the gentle inquiry, what's happening? What's happening here? What is this experience? Touching into a different kind of knowing, not the intellectual knowledge, but the direct felt sense experience, what's happening in this moment. Investigation could also include recognizing, is this wholesome, is this unwholesome? Is this skillful? Is this unskillful? Investigation could also include the question of, how am I relating to this? Am I making it worse? Am I making it better? Investigation is bringing us closer to the experience, to notice that there might be thinking happening, but not engage with or feed that thinking, but really to drop into the visceral experience. Where is there tension? Can I soften it? Where is there activation? Can I stay with this experience? Can I breathe with it? Can I breathe through it? Can I watch the constellations of energies that might be moving and shifting and changing? It's a kind of feedback loop, actually, that allows us to begin to adjust. For the most part, on this list, you know, our agency and our effort is in the application of mindfulness and the application of investigation. You know, we can do things around the edges that work with joy and concentration, and we can manage our energy. But for the most part, it's just that. Those are the seeds that you plant. And the continuation of the practice creates the conditions where those other factors will naturally come to fruition. And equanimity at the end of the list, it's at the end of a lot of the Buddhist lists, seen as, you know, one of the culminations of practice, when the mind is just steady and even and unperturbed, not so at odd with conditions. Can't will ourselves into equanimity. We have to cultivate and create the conditions that lead to a mind that's undisturbed. And as Inez was saying earlier, you know, the more we do this, the easier it becomes. The quote I shared the other day, whatever a person keeps pursuing, what they're thinking and pondering, that becomes the inclination of the awareness. And the neuroscientists also say, you know, neurons that wire together fire together. As we continually cultivate the wholesome, we actually create stronger, more efficient neural pathways to activate those wholesome states. Another area of cultivation of the wholesome that I've devoted a lot of energy to is the cultivation of metta, loving kindness, friendliness, universal positive regard, this kind of state of being that is where the heart is imbued with a kind of pure, unattached love. And that can be very simple. I like these words from the Dalai Lama. There's no need for temples, no need for complicated philosophies. This is from someone who's mastered, you know, huge volumes of esoteric Vajrayana teachings. There's no need for temples, no need for complicated philosophies. My brain and my heart are my temples, and my philosophy is kindness. And then he says, be kind whenever possible. It's always possible. And this is very true to, you know, the early teachings of the Buddha as well. Like, he described this in a very radical, graphic way in the simile of the saw. He said, even if bandits were to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handed saw, one who gives rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. That's a really high bar. You know, someone's... and it comes from, you know, of course, that high bar is aspirational at best, but it's I like these extreme examples because it's a reminder of the limitless capacity of the heart. The Buddha described the method for cultivating loving kindness. And it's, you know, the original teaching is quite different from what we have adopted as the common practice of using phrases and visualizations. It's a more kind of felt sense, energetic practice. He says, someone's describing how to cultivate it, and they say, I will abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere, as to all and to myself. I will abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. And I love this feeling and idea of, you know, the heart is filled with this energy of metta, and I'm just beaming it out in every direction with this sense that the beings that receive it are, you know, suffused with my care for them. The Buddha also said, when the deliverance of mind by loving kindness is developed, no limiting action remains there, none persists there. And I love this phrase, no limiting action remains. It's pointing to the fact that when we have ill will or anger or resentments, frustration, maybe even boredom, all things that are not metta, that these things are unwholesome, that these states of mind and heart, they limit us, they color our perception. And we all know this, like when you go through the world grumpy, it colors your perception in a way that makes it difficult to see all the beauty in the world, obscures the liberative truth of how things are, and agitates our system in a way that it's hard to be peaceful. I always think I'm going to run out of things to say, and then I always end up having more to say than there is time. I was exposed to meditation as a child. I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama, and there was a little Zen community there, surprisingly. It's founded by this amazing Korean Zen master who had a vision of having, I think, hundreds of communities around the world, but they were all in kind of far-flung places, not in major cities, but in smaller towns where people were interested. And I would go to this sangha. They rented a little house, and I would, you know, I think I was 5, maybe 6, and I was a very mischievous child, so I would get right up in people's faces as they were meditating and blow on them or try to distract them. I would sit in people's laps, and no one flinched. It was such a beautiful community. Like, people were just so equanimous. When I would sit in someone's lap, I would feel like a gentle embrace. And then when I squirmed enough, they would let me go. I remember this so vividly. This was actually became a memory arose of this when I was going through a hard time of just the quality of being of this community. There was a lot of laughter and people would, they paid attention to me in a way that I was not used to as a 5-year-old child. Like people coming down to my level and really attending to what I had to say. I had a lot to say and no one was much interested in listening to it. So one time the Crane Zen Master was coming through to visit. And I remember my father and I went to the airport and we picked him up and we brought him to this little house that was being rented for the Sangha. And he was, you know, he was described to me as very old, and I think he was probably 70. You know, my dad at the time was 30, so it wasn't, you know, it seemed old. It doesn't seem so old now. But he was very youthful and very ebullient and energetic. And so he bounded out of the car and up this sort of half flight of steps to the screen door, which is the backside of the, where the main sitting room was. And he didn't realize that the screen door was closed. And in the most cartoonish fashion you can imagine, he bounced off the screen door, fell backwards, rolled down a half a flight of steps, rolled like another 10 feet onto the driveway, face up, unconscious. And it was, I remember how quiet it was. Everyone was just like frozen, just looking at, oh no, what just happened? And then someone in the Sangha who was especially funny said, oh crap, we killed the master. and then we're just kind of chuckling, you know, which seemed really inappropriate because he was unconscious. But then he came to and he just started laughing and laughing and laughing. Pretty soon we were all laughing. Such a beautiful teaching. You know, there's so many ways one could react to being injured like that. You could be angry, you could be blaming, you could be embarrassed. And he had cultivated his mind in such a way that what naturally arose was just this ebullience, you know, this, like, that was just his default state. He saw the humor in it. So I think I'd like to end by sharing a video, which is something like, I don't do that often, but we can do it on Zoom. And it's very much relates. It's very dharmic, I think. I was going to leave you with these words. Keep going. It's really sort of the, you know, we're talking about in one of the groups, somebody said, you know, okay, now what? And it's like, there is no now what, just keep going. And so this song is called the Keep Going Song. Some of you may have seen this. It's a husband and wife duo of musicians who wrote this, I think, you know, maybe a few months into the pandemic as a kind of offering to the world that was going through this difficult time. So I'm going to share sound, optimize for video clip. Screen 3, you all disappeared. So somebody unmute and tell me if you can't hear it.
This is the keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going on, keep going on song. This is the keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going on, keep going on song. This is a keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going on, keep going on song.
I am Abigail, and this is Sean, and we're so glad that you've turned this on and welcomed us into your home, and you are welcome into our home. We're in Dayton, Ohio.
Dayton, Ohio.
We're in Sean's parents' house.
My parents' house.
Sean's parents' house. We were in Louisville when the shit hit, and we packed our three-year-old into a car. We drove kind of far, we drove here, and we've been so lucky and blessed to be safely here. And we thought we'd be here for like 10 days, tops.
What did we know?
What did we know?
What did, we know?
We thought we knew a lot. We thought we knew a lot.
Keep going, keep going, woo! Keep going on.
Keep going on, song. This is a keep going, keep going, keep going on. Keep going on, song. This is a keep going, keep going, keep going on. Keep going on, song. And we've been mostly healthy. We've been okay. Are you okay? Are you alright? Are you okay? Are you alright? Are you okay? I hope your body is whole tonight. And if your heart is breaking, I hope it's breaking open. And if your breath is shaking, I hope it's shaking through. And then I hope that you've watched a lot of really great television, like a lot of it. And I hope that you find a hand lotion that actually makes your skin feel better. And I hope that you have enough to eat. I hope you're getting enough sleep. And I hope you have enough good company or enough good memory to last you a long time.
Keep going on, song. We sing that keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going on. Keep going on, song.
Let's bring some joy into the room, why not? We can try it, we can try it. Or some rage.
Keep going, keep going.
And some grief and relief. My rage, I pray my rage is a fire that cleans my mind out and makes me ready to listen. I pray my pain is a river that flows to the ocean that connects my pain to yours. And I pray my happiness is like pollen that flies to you and pollinates your joy. Oh boy, oh boy, is that possible? I don't know, I don't know. We are making this up as we go. We have to make it up as we go. The keep going song, the keep going song. Oh, we're making it up. We're making it up as we go.
Keep going, keep going, keep going on. Keep going on, song.
And I pray that when we meet again, that the world has changed. The world that we are imagining now together. And I pray that the world has become the world that we're planting inside of ourselves for each other and for our ancestors and for our kids. Ooh, and we're gonna start, we're gonna start. This is a rough beginning. That's all I've got is a rough beginning to offer you. We're gonna start by singing some songs in this tiny space together. We're just gonna sing some songs for you, and we hope that when you hear them, you will feel a little bit less alone. And we will feel a little bit less alone in the work and in the hurt. And we will be together tonight somehow, whenever this is, wherever this is. We will be together tonight. For the
keep going on song. This is
Yeah, I thought they're really great, and there's so much generosity and wisdom in that. Thank you for your kind attention. Still lots to go in the retreat. Keep going. See you soon.